welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, broadcasting programs from radio's past. I'm your host, Mark Levenier. In this hour, true history. Later on, we hear about the listening years on CBS's There. But right now, a true story on the Cavalcade of America, with actress Loretta Young portraying Eliza McCardle, who had a close connection with President Andrew Johnson. This was first heard on NBC on October 31st, 1950.
DuPont Company of Wilmington, Delaware, makers of better things for better living through chemistry, presents the Cavalcade of America. Tonight's star, Miss Loretta Young.
Tonight's DuPont Cavalcade, starring Miss Loretta Young, is called Whither Thou Goest, and begins in the mountains of Tennessee on a Saturday afternoon in September in the year 1826, and with a girl named Eliza McCardle.
The first time I set eyes on Andy Johnson, I was standing at the gate of my house, and coming toward me down the dusty road, I saw him. He was leading a blind horse, which was pulling the most ramshackle, creaky cart in the whole world.
Oh. Oh. Excuse me, miss, but could you tell me what town this is?
Why, you're in Greenville.
I'm right obliged to you. Could you tell me, is there a tailor here in Greenville?
There is indeed, a fine tailor.
Oh, I see. I'm mighty obliged to you.
Is something wrong?
Well, I don't suppose Greenville will be big enough to support two tailors.
I don't suppose. Barely enough to support one. Look, I don't want to seem forward, but my name is Eliza McCardle.
Oh, I'm Andy Johnson.
Oh?
Come up from Carolina, my family and me. Up across the mountains.
Oh, it's a long way to come and a hard way. You must be tired.
Guess we are. You don't suppose, do you, Miss Eliza, there'd be empty cabin somewhere we could get the rent of for a few days?
Well, Mr. Armitage down at the store could tell you that. If you'll be good enough to follow me, I'll be glad to show you the way.
Oh, I thank you kindly.
Mr. Armitage?
Good morning.
This is Mr. Andy Johnson. He's come to Tennessee all the way from Carolina.
Looks it, doesn't he? On his hands and knees?
Oh, don't mind him, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Armitage, I've come to inquire about renting an empty house.
Oh, you and John Pringle fixing to get hitched?
I beg your pardon, Mr. Armitage.
You can't stop a man from guessing.
No, the house is not for me. It's for Mr. Johnson.
Hasn't Mr. Johnson here a tongue?
I have, Mr. Armitage, a civil tongue.
Well, he's got spunk. Question is, has he got any rent money?
The answer to that question is no.
That's what I thought.
But I have got needle, thread, thimble, and shears. I can pay rent by making you a coat out of that there bowl of cloth on your shelf.
You can?
Yes, sir.
A coat with tails on it?
Yes, sir.
You have rented yourself a house, Mr. Johnson. Now let's see what kind of coat I get.
I used to pass by and see him sitting cross-legged on the table, his needle winking through the cloth, his fingers working very fast, very sure. It was on the second Tuesday that he made me a business offer.
I could pay you 15 cents. Cash money.
For doing what, Mr. Johnson?
Reading to me. Never had an education. Would you help me learn by myself, commencing by reading to me?
Oh, I couldn't rightly take money for reading to a person.
Why not, Miss Eliza?
Well, people don't get paid for reading to people.
Well, in tailor shops they do. Once a cloth is cut, fingers can sew almost by themselves.
By themselves?
That's what I mean. While fingers work, ears can listen.
Oh, I couldn't take pay. I'm sorry.
Excuse me. I guess I shouldn't have brought it up.
Shouldn't have, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Miss Eliza.
Do you really mean you never had any schooling at all? Not ever?
Would you mind handing me the shears?
Oh.
Thanks. Pa died when I was 5. Ma took in washing. She couldn't afford to send me to pay school. Weren't any other kind in Raleigh.
Oh.
Got the habit of going into a tailor shop in Raleigh. A journeyman and his boy sat cross-legged while they sewed. And they'd pay somebody to read. I sat in a corner and listened, making myself small so nobody'd notice.
And that was your education?
Yes, Miss Eliza.
Well, who taught you your letters?
I did. Oh. I kept asking one of the men. By the time I got to work there, I knew my A to Z.
Well, didn't you ever go out to play with all the children?
Learning's play, especially if you never had learning.
Mr. Johnson, I'll be very glad to teach you to read and while you work.
I thank you kindly.
But it won't be for pay. I'll do it for friendship. Now, listen to this, Mr. Johnson. It's from the Bible.
All right.
And she said, "Behold, thy sister-in-law is gone back unto her people, unto her gods. Return thou after thy sister-in-law." And Ruth said, "Entreat me not to leave thee, or to return from following after thee. For whither thou goest, I will go, and whither thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God, my God."
She did all that for friendship.
Yes, Andy, she did. Only it was for more than friendship. For love. For loyalty.
There's another part later on that I like.
Oh?
"Why have I found grace in thine eyes, that thou shouldst take knowledge of me, seeing I am a stranger?"
You learned that by heart.
I think I know the whole book of Ruth by heart.
Oh.
If I hear a thing a few times, I know it.
Oh, you're an unusual man, Mr. Johnson.
I'm ignorant Carolina mudsill.
Oh, no, no. You're different. You're too sober, maybe. Almost bitter. You know, you should laugh more often.
Thank you. What have I got to laugh about? Being ignorant, being shut off from books. I'm a grown man and I can't write my own name. It's like a chain around my neck. Eliza, it chokes the breath out of me.
You called me Liza.
I won't do it again. I'm sorry. I beg your pardon.
Oh, but I want you to.
You better not come here anymore, Miss McArdle.
I'll teach you to write. Andrew Johnson, do you hear me? I will teach you to write. Your name, letters, everything.
Why?
I believe in you. You're not going to be just a tailor.
Miss McArdle, I ain't going to be nothing else.
Don't say ain't.
And I ain't going to be taking your time when there's Greenville gentry who might be a-courting you.
Well, I have no interest in the gentry of Greenville, and stop saying ain't.
I'm ignorant. I talk ignorant. Not like John Pringle. I seen you with him on the street.
You're being deliberately ungrammatical in order to provoke me. You... Why, Andy Johnson, I do believe you're jealous.
I'm being sensible. Greenville hasn't got room for 2 tailors. The work I got from Mr. Armitage will be done in a week. I'll be leaving Greenville, Miss McArdle. Leaving for good.
Because he thought he wasn't good enough for me. Because he couldn't write his own name. Because he was poor, Andrew Johnson piled his belongings on a rickety cart, and he and his mother and his stepfather took the mountain road out of Greenville. They traveled to the town of Rutledge, 75 miles away. Winter closed in, and there was no word of Andy Johnson. No word until spring, when storekeeper Armitage sent for me.
Your friend Andy Johnson has built himself a fine, thriving business.
Oh?
Man just came by and told me.
Oh.
Yeah. Got his own little shop.
Well, I'm glad to hear it.
No, you're not.
Oh, but I am. I am. I wish him well. I wish him success and good health and contentment.
Not in Rutledge. His place is right here, in Greenville.
Well, I'm afraid there isn't anything to bring him back here.
No, but there is.
Well, I can't agree with you.
I'm a powerfully dumb man, Liza McArdle, but I know whose face has been before his eyes these 6 months. Oh. It ain't mine.
No, you're exaggerating, Mr. Armitage. We knew each other for a little while, and two young people who just came together briefly and then went apart.
All he wants is an excuse to come back here.
Well, there's no work for him here. Greenville already has a tailor.
Who's pulling up stakes?
What did you say?
Yeah, the old tailor's quitting. If you hadn't been moping, Liza McArdle, that wouldn't have been news to you. It's been town gossip since January.
But Mr. Johnson has a thriving business in Rutledge. Why would he come here?
Don't you know, Liza? He'll be coming back.
Such things just didn't happen in true life. Then why was it happening to me? Why did I go to the South Road each day and listen for the sound of a creaking cart? And finally, when I heard the sound and saw the sound and proved what was causing the sound, why did I run away and hide in my own room?
Liza, wake up.
I'm not sleeping, Mother.
Well, there's someone here to see you. And it isn't John Pringle.
Oh, my hair. Oh, Mother, please tell him to go away. Say that I'm... Just say anything to him. Oh,
there's nothing wrong with your hair, Liza.
But my face, Mother.
It's a good face. You know, I shouldn't be arguing with you. I should be more calculating and want a rich man's son for you, someone like John Pringle. But, my dear, there's something about this young man that makes me wish I was 20 years younger.
Well, Mother, what are you saying?
I'm saying I'm a brazen woman. Now bite your lips a little and pinch your cheeks.
Yeah.
Put a little color in your face.
Yeah.
There, that's better. He's in the garden waiting. Run, my dear. I know I'd run.
Hello, Eliza.
Hello, Andy.
Your face has changed a little.
Oh, has it?
You look older.
Oh, well, I am older.
You look paler.
Oh.
I'm glad to see you.
Oh.
I've come back to be the tailor of Greenville.
Oh, yeah. So Mother tells me.
That isn't the only reason I've come back.
No?
I love you, Eliza. But at this moment, I'm not asking you to marry me.
You're not asking?
Oh, I've got too much respect for Eliza McArdle to ask her to marry a man who can't even write down his own name proper.
Properly?
Yes, ma'am, who can't even write his own name properly.
That's more proper. Is that all?
Well, don't make fun of me, Eliza. It's a terrible thing for a grown man not to be able to write. I'm serious.
I'm serious, Andy. And I ask you again, is that all?
That's all, Eliza.
Oh, well then... Sit right down on that rock.
What for?
Just sit right down on that rock there and wait for me.
Where are you going?
I'm going to bring a copybook. Andy Johnson, I'm teaching you how to write. Now, don't go away.
Looking for someone, Miss Eliza?
Oh. Why, John Pringle, what are you doing here?
You expect someone else?
Well, when I went inside,
Mr. Johnson asked me to pay his regrets.
Mr. Johnson did?
He did, ma'am. An urgent matter of business took him off.
John, You didn't quarrel with him.
Oh, I never quarrel with tradespeople, Miss Eliza.
Well, that's mighty condescending of you. Where did he go?
Well, I gave the fella my measurements, and he agreed to make a new suit of clothes for me. I explained that I wanted it in 2 days, because on Friday I'll have a new horse and rig. And you wouldn't want to go driving with a gentleman in a new rig, but an old suit, would you, Miss Lyon?
John Pringle, I'm going to marry Andrew Johnson.
Well, there's no quality in the man, Lyon.
We won't discuss him.
You're throwing yourself away.
And they won't discuss me.
Then we'll discuss me. You know what I have to offer?
Yes, John. And thank you very much.
Is that all you have to say?
Yes, and I happen to be very busy. I'm engaged in teaching my future husband how to write his name. And now, if you'll excuse me, John, I'll just see where he's gone.
This is a story that took place 125 years ago in the mountains of Tennessee. The simple story of a tailor and the girl who loved him.
Andy, why did you go away?
I have nothing to give you. Seeing that man, I realized it.
I'm entitled to a better explanation than that.
It ain't good to be poor.
Isn't. Speak grammatically. You're going to amount to something. Speak grammatically.
Oh, you're wasting your time with
me. I'll be the judge of that.
You'll be poor.
Well, it's no disgrace.
Well, it ain't no honor either.
Isn't. If you say ain't once more, I'll slap your face.
You'll be poor. Have you ever been real poor? I've seen my mother poor. I know how a woman gets ground down when she has to spend every minute of her life struggling for a piece of bread. It eats all the goodness out of a person, all the woman out of her.
Are you finished?
She gets old before her time and bitter before her time and resigned to die before her time.
Now, look here. John Pringle intended to humiliate you. Why did you allow him to do it?
I ain't saying.
I told you I'd slap you if you said ain't. I warned you.
You got a temper, ain't you?
You're making me hit you.
Yeah, that could be.
And you let John Pringle send you away. I was never more ashamed.
Well, he asked me to make him a suit of clothes. I'm a tailor.
Well, have you no pride, Mr. Johnson?
If you wish, no pride.
Have you no self-respect, then?
If you wish, no self-respect.
Oh.
But John Pringle will give you a fine house. Your children will never know want. They say he'll stand for the legislature, and he'll be elected. He's the one who'll amount to something.
Oh, we're speaking like little children, both of us. Andrew Johnson, everything spoken between us is idle and senseless. I will stand in church on Sunday, and I will say aloud to all the townspeople, I wish to marry Andrew Johnson. He does not wish it.
Well, you'll say a lie, then.
Is it a lie?
Well, I'm nothing. I have no right to you.
Then I have rights which you must respect. Sit down on that doorstep of your shop. Sit down there and take this copybook in your hand.
I like that.
Sir, don't interrupt me. Don't you dare. Now, you'll copy each letter I've written down. Capital A, small a. Capital B, small b. Capital C, small c. Each letter will sit on the ruled line. It will not slant up the line, and nor will it slip down. Because each letter will have respect for itself. And you will have respect for yourself. Your ink, Andrew Johnson. Your quill. Please begin.
Yes, Eliza.
Stop digging. You're writing, not plowing. Hold your quill so, and keep the tip of your tongue inside your mouth. Now remember that and do it better.
Yes, Eliza.
You blotted the paper again. Don't splotch. Write your letters. Don't smear them. Once again.
Yes, Eliza.
Don't cramp your writing. The only writing worth reading is written in a free hand.
Yes, Eliza.
There. That's better. Andy Johnson, you exasperate me. Aren't you ever gonna kiss me?
Yes, Eliza.
He worked hard. He sat cross-legged in his shop tailoring for the people of Greenville. And I read to him while he sewed. I read the Constitution of the United States. I read the Declaration of Independence. I read the speeches of Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. I read the laws of the state of Tennessee. I read hard facts to him, and his mind was like a sponge. Whatever I read, his mind took up and held. He learned to put on paper the things in his mind. He learned well, very well. One day he put his needle down and he gave me his copybook.
I wrote it down this morning.
Ah, it's good writing, Andy.
I didn't copy it from the book. I just put the words down as I remembered them.
Oh.
Entreat me not to leave thee, or to return from following after thee. For whither thou goest, I will go. And where thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God, my God. Where thou diest, will I die, and there will I be buried. The Lord do so to me and more also, if aught but death do part thee and me.
Oh, Andy.
I have spoken to Squire Mordecai Lincoln, Eliza.
Mm?
He will marry us.
Mm. My husband. Andrew Johnson, an ordinary man. By day he was a tailor. By night he read the law. He read the law and he began to speak to other men. The people listened to him. First a few, then many. They made him a county judge. Then they sent him to Congress. They made him the governor of Tennessee. They made him the vice president of the United States of America. There was a shot fired on April the 14th, 1865. A shot that was fired in Ford's Theater in Washington. A shot fired at a man named Abraham Lincoln.
Is Mr. Johnson ready?
He is, sir.
A Bible?
On the table, sir.
Oh, thank you. I believe we may begin. Andrew Johnson, place your hand upon the Bible. Repeat now after me. I do solemnly swear.
I do solemnly swear.
That I will faithfully execute.
That I will faithfully execute.
The office of President of the United States.
The office of President of the United States.
A tailor boy, born in Carolina, succeeding a rail splitter, born in Kentucky. Two men who lived and died so that the Federal Union of the American States might be preserved forever. One of them, Andrew Johnson, my beloved husband.
Miss Loretta Young, Wesley Addy, and the Cavalcade Players for tonight's play, Whither Thou Goest. Miss Loretta Young is currently starred in the Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer production, Cause for Alarm. On tonight's Cavalcade, the part of Andrew Johnson was played by Wesley Addy, and the script was written by Morton Wishengrad. Original music was composed by Arden Cornwell and conducted by Donald Voorhees. The program was directed by John Zoller. This is Cy Harris speaking and reminding our listeners that the young men of our nation have excellent advantages, both to themselves and in helping build America's strength by joining the National Guard, a military organization of great traditions and service.
The Cavalcade of America on Tuned to Yesterday from the last day of October 1950 on NBC, starring Loretta Young. In that year, she was paired with Clark Gable in the comedy romance Key to the City, which also co-starred Frank Morgan, singer Marilyn Maxwell, and Raymond Burr. It's an hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark LeVanier. And now with a forerunner to the You Are There series on CBS, they bring us an amalgam of historical events in CBS's There, The Listening Years. This first turn on the network on November 6th, 1947.
Years when CBS brought you the sound of history, of great events. Events made more vivid and unforgettable because when they happen, as they happen,
CBS is there.
Tonight, for National Radio Week, CBS is there recreates actual broadcasts of notable events selected from the listening years. You will hear a president, a prisoner, a king, and plain people speaking to you again as they spoke to you before in memorable microphone moments. And now, with John Daly as narrator,
The Listening Years, CBS is there.
You have waited 3 years, 8 months, and 25 days for this moment. You have fought, worked, sacrificed, and prayed, and now it is here. Somewhere in the Pacific, it is happening 3,800 miles beyond Pearl Harbor, and you in Terre Haute, Okinawa, Berlin, and Birmingham, on ships at sea and down in mines, in crowded cities and RFD routes, you are there.
Attention, peoples of the world. World War II is about to come to its official closing. We are on the Pacific Fleet flagship, USS Missouri, in Tokyo Bay for the signing of the surrender of Japan. We're on the veranda deck. Its great guns are pointed skyward to allow room for the Army, Navy, Marines, and the representatives of the nations who are here. Lieutenant General Jonathan Wainwright is here, he who surrendered at Corregidor, and Lieutenant General Arthur Percival, who surrendered at Singapore. With the Supreme Commander of the Allied Forces, General of the Army, Douglas MacArthur, and with him the Admiral of the Fleet, Chester Nimitz, and other dignitaries. General MacArthur is now facing the microphone.
I now invite the representatives of the Emperor of Japan to sign the instrument of surrender at the places indicated.
Shigemitsu, Foreign Minister of the Japanese government, is stepping forward now. Shigemitsu, we see, has it's a wooden leg, apparently. He pulls the chair back. He's about to sit down. He takes off his silk top hat, pulling off his gloves, long yellow gloves. General MacArthur is waiting. He's looking down at Mr. Shigemitsu. Mr. Shigemitsu looks at his watch for some reason, consults some papers in his pocket. He's looking for a pen. He's got another watch. He's checking two watches. Well, at last he's got a pen out and he's preparing to do something, although he hasn't yet faced himself up to the surrender document. He's trying to get some ink out of the pen holder, which has no ink in it. Mr. Shigemitsu has some ink in his pen and he's ready to sign the document. It's a huge thing, about a foot and a half long by a foot wide, printed up in beautiful gold type. I can almost read it from here. Mr. Shigemitsu is affixing his signature to the official surrender document. Here's another signature. Mr. Shigemitsu is doubly signing two documents here, of course, one copy for Japan, one copy for the Allies. Mr. Shigemitsu has signed the American copy. He's now signing the Japanese copy. I can almost watch him spell his name out. He's closing up his pen. Japan has surrendered, and there goes a flight of giant B-29s overhead.
September 1st, 1945. Japan surrenders unconditionally, and World War II is over. CBS is there.
You are watching the last act of the greatest romance the modern world has known. How will it turn out? Will the king give up his empire or his love? He cannot have both. This is Antony and Cleopatra, Romeo and Juliet, Napoleon and Josephine. But this time, you don't have to wait for a Shakespeare or a Shaw to put it on a stage. This final curtain is real and now. And you, in kitchens and beauty parlors and soda fountains, you are there.
This is Windsor Castle. His Royal Highness, Prince Edward. At long last, I am able to say a few words of my own. I have never wanted to withhold anything. But until now, it has not been constitutionally possible for me to speak. A few hours ago, I discharged my last duty as king and emperor. And now that I have been succeeded by my brother, the Duke of York, my first words must be to declare my allegiance to him. This I do with all my heart. You all know the reason which has impelled me to renounce the throne. You must believe me when I tell you that I have found it impossible to carry the heavy burden of responsibility and to discharge my duties as king, as I would wish to do, without the help and support of the woman I love. And I want you to know that the decision I have made has been mine and mine alone. This was a thing I had to judge.
December 11th, 1936. King Edward VIII abdicates. CBS is there.
Put the kids to bed, and you and the missus are spending this quiet spring evening at home reading because it's too chilly to go out. She's reading the latest bestseller, Edna Ferber's Cimarron, and you're thumbing through a copy of the Literary Digest. Suddenly, you're bored. You put the magazine down and walk over to your super heterodyne and casually start twisting the dials, tuning from station to station, listening for something to listen to.
Fire at the Ohio State Penitentiary here in Columbus on the 21st day of April, 1930. The suspense of the moment is whether or not the firefighters can get into the burning wing right before me to unlock the two topmost tiers, cell blocks G and H. There are approximately 150 men trapped in there. They'd better get in there fast or else those men inside are lost and their number will be added to the already ghastly total of about 200 prisoners already suffocated and burned to death and 300 injured in this terrible, terrible disaster. The scene around me is inferno. The prison yard is lit up by batteries of floodlights on the walls, by the flames of the fire itself. Hundreds of men milling around here, firemen, guards, soldiers from Fort Myers with bayoneted rifles, nurses, doctors, priests, ministers, interns. All the convicts have been let out except those trapped up in this wing. Some of the convicts have escaped. One just walked out the front gate in all the confusion. Many of the prisoners are helping, carrying out dead and injured and laying them down on the lawn in front of the guardhouse. They're covered with tarpaulins, newspapers, blankets. It's a horrible scene. And now, here's a convict. Here's prisoner number X46812, a former preacher, probably the best known man in this prison, a lifer doing time for murder. I'm going to ask him to describe what's going on here in Columbus, Ohio, this awful night of April 21st, 1930. All right, go ahead. Go ahead, talk.
My eyes is looking out on hell here tonight. When the fire came in my wing, there wasn't any time to pull my brethren out of the cells. We couldn't get the poor sinners out in time. Now, they're bringing them out. Now, they're bringing my brethren out. My precious ones, the ones I've worked with, the ones I've prayed with, the ones I had tonight, the mess hall. They're bringing them out dead and dying like brands. What from...
This is CBS in the Paramount Building in New York. Due to transmission difficulties, we've been forced to interrupt our dramatic broadcast from inside the walls of the Ohio State Penitentiary, where a fire is raging this night of April 21st, 1930. We're trying to... What? We have made contact with our CBS announcer again. So over to Columbus.
One of the prisoners here describing in his own words what's going on. The fire in this wing before me, the one in which the 150 prisoners are trapped in their locked cells, this fire is completely out of control. The firemen are pulling away. The walls beginning to go. The roof. You can see the bars. You can see them. This is terrible. This is terrible. Nothing anybody can do. The wall. The wall. The wing has collapsed. It's down. All down. The men are lost. I've never seen anything like this before in my life.
April 21st, 1930. The Ohio State Penitentiary burns. CBS is there.
You're worried. There is a new frightening word, depression. You're afraid you'll lose your job, afraid your bank will fail. You're afraid they'll take away your house, your farm. It seems as though the country is crumbling. But out of the rain...
This is preeminently the time to speak the truth, the whole truth, frankly and boldly. Nor need we shrink from honestly facing conditions in our country today. This great nation will endure as it has endured, will revive and will prosper. So, first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror.
March 4th, 1933, the first inaugural. CBS is there.
You are at peace, but the other side of the world is at war. You are a worker in the arsenal for democracy, a soldier in training, a parent dreading the inevitable. You search your very soul. You ask, what's all the shooting about? And you get the answer.
In the future days, which we seek to make secure, we look forward to a world founded upon four essential human freedoms. The first is freedom of speech and expression everywhere in the world. The second is freedom of every person to worship God in his own way everywhere in the world. The third is freedom from want, which translated into world terms means economic understandings which will secure to every nation healthy peacetime life for its inhabitants everywhere in the world. The fourth is freedom from fear, which translated into world terms means a worldwide reduction.
January 6th, 1941. A message to Congress. CBS is there.
And now you are staggering from a cowardly attack. You're all fury and dedication to what lies ahead, and 140 million of you speak with one voice.
I believe I interpret the will of the Congress and of the people when I assert that we will not only defend ourselves to the uttermost, but will make very certain that this form of treachery shall never endanger us again. With confidence in our armed forces, with the unbounded determination of our people, we will gain the inevitable triumph. So help us God. I ask Congress declare that since the unprovoked and dastardly attack by Japan on Sunday, December 7th, a state of war...
December 8th, 1941. The war message. CBS is there.
Now the guns are speaking, tearing apart the fabric of your life. Now you are at war. There are oceans between you and your son and father and brother. It's Christmas, but there are empty places at your holiday table, voices missing from the carols you long to hear, and radio is there to knit you and them together again.
This broadcast of transatlantic call, people to people, there's time for just one more shortwave conversation today. Kenneth Collins, 14... a fine, red-headed, freckle-faced American boy wants to speak to his father in London. Is he there?
Here he is, right in front of me. Go ahead, Colonel Collins.
Hello, Dad.
Yes. Dad. My gracious, your voice has dropped so about a whole octave.
Well, almost, yes.
What are you now, the head of the family?
Yes, just about.
Well, are you so big that you can wear all my clothes?
Oh, yes. When you come home, there'll be just about one moth-eaten pair of trousers left.
Oh, my. I hoped you'd got so big that you couldn't wear them at all.
Oh, I will be soon.
Is your mother there?
What's that, Dad? What?
I say, is your mother there?
Oh, she's out in the studio, and she stands all in love, and so does Sydney.
Well, is she just as beautiful as the day I went away?
Oh, yes.
Then can you feel just the way I do?
Yes, Dad, I...
Tell me, Kenny, how's the baby?
Oh, she's fine.
Did she pull over the Christmas tree yesterday?
No, not quite. Just about, though.
Yes, you used to do that.
I did?
Oh, yes, all the time.
Dad.
How's your behavior at school?
What, Dad?
Your behavior. How is your behavior?
Oh, fine.
Is it as good as mine was at your age?
I hope so.
Well, every generation is supposed to get a little better than the one before.
Well, I couldn't be much better.
Oh. Well, Kenny, our time's getting short.
Dad, I guess...
The Scotch people here have a very, very lovely way of saying goodbye.
Yes?
Yes, they always say, God bless. I want to say God bless to you, to Mother, little Sydney, all your grandparents, and it comes from the bottom of my heart, son.
Well, goodbye, Dad. And come home soon.
I wish we didn't have to, but our transatlantic family reunion is just about over.
Christmas,
before we go,
1943. New York and London. CBS is there.
You know it has to come sometime. You know it must come. You know, we have to start the road back to where they began because it will never be over unless we hit their own beachheads. And then while you're waiting, wondering when it will come, where it will come, it does come, and you are there.
This is London. Under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France.
This is London again. Actual recordings made across the channel during the invasion landings in the last few hours are beginning to come in from the war correspondents representing the combined American networks. We're going to play one of those recordings for you now. An actual recording, not a recreation. It was made at daybreak by George Hicks on an American warship off the coast of France under attack by Nazi planes.
Our own ship has just gave its warning whistles, and now flak is coming up in the sky.
Here we go again, another plane's come over. Before before they burst. Tracer's still going up. And now the plane has probably gone beyond.
Years of radio, the listening years, when the sounds of the world you live in began to come alive, to come into your own living room, your office, your car, ranging you with the great and epic moments of history, seating you at the ringside in the grandstand on the 50-yard line, making you neighbor and confidant of kings and cabinets, thrusting you suddenly and dramatically into the heat of breaking news, giving your government a voice and you a greater voice in government, to carry you on the worldwide waves of battle to victory and into the nervous tides of peace. And now, the very now, at this instant, while you wonder what the sound of tomorrow will be, CBS is where tomorrow is coming to be, where the news is breaking. CBS is there today, now.
This is Robert Lewis speaking to you from the caucus room of the Senate Office Building in Washington. This is the second day of the reopened Hughes hearings. Committee Chairman Ferguson of Michigan is questioning an Air Force official about the highly controversial F-11, the Hughes photo reconnaissance plane. The hearings, both yesterday and today, have been drab and dull compared to the wild scenes we saw in August when Howard Hughes, Johnny Meyer, and Elliot Roosevelt were in the witness chair. On the stand now is Brigadier General J.F. Phillips, wartime chief of the Materiel Division of the U.S. Army Air Forces. As we pick up the testimony by tape recording, Senator Ferguson is speaking to General Phillips.
Did you discuss any men in public life about the plane?
Oh, yes.
Who?
In the history of the plane, quite some time before that, there was a note from... I recall assigned FDR, what is there in this airplane? Not the F-11, that was the D-2, as I recall it.
Yeah, but the history of it, the history of this plane. Well, did you discuss that with the group?
I expect I mentioned that.
Well, then it could have been that Riley...
And so went the Hughes investigation today here in Washington. There was more news at the United Nations, for that here's Larry Lesser in New York.
This is Larry Lesser. At the United Nations here at Lake Success today,
Britain's Sir Hartley Shawcross speaks on the proposal for the so-called Little Assembly.
Can one imagine Mr. Vyshinsky getting up in court and addressing the tribunal and saying, "Gentlemen of the jury, this prisoner is guilty. Evidence, don't let's bother about evidence. Pravda says he's guilty. TASS proclaims he's guilty. Documentary proof? Gentlemen, this is a farce. I say he is guilty. He is flagrantly guilty. Off with his head. Off to Siberia."
The chairman, Joseph Besh of Luxembourg, then recognizes the delegate of the Soviet Union, Andrei Vyshinsky.
Такими, знаете ли, ласковыми, обвораживающими глазами удав смотрит на троне.
His gray head bobbing up and down, Mr. Vyshinsky vigorously declares his opposition to the formation of the so-called Little Assembly. I am listening to the English translation over my earphone. Mr. Vyshinsky is comparing Mr. Shawcross to a snake. A snake which, he says, transfixes a rabbit with its magnetic eyes and says, "Won't you let me embrace you?" Then crushes the rabbit. But, says Mr. Vyshinsky, Mr. Shawcross has miscalculated. Mr. Shawcross does not have the magnetic eyes of a boa constrictor, and Russia is not a rabbit. And so the international debate goes on another day in the United Nations. CBS is there today, tomorrow, always.
This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
CBS is there on Tuned to Yesterday from November 6th, 1947. And that closes this hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's golden age. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levanier. Thanks for listening.